This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
Support for this podcast comes from U.S. Bank. U.S. Bank wants to know how you reward yourself because they have cards that make every day more rewarding. Are you a points hoarder, cashback guru, low intro APR lover? With U.S. Bank, it's up to you because they have the cards to fit your lifestyle. So earn more whether you're shopping at a gas station or grocery store, even while planning a staycation. Learn more at usbank.com/creditcard. U.S. Bank credit cards are issued by U.S. Bank National Association N.D. Some restrictions may apply. Member FDIC.
Welcome to the RotoWire Mixed Martial Arts Podcast, brought to you by ESPN Plus, the home of UFC 249. I'm Jake Litarski, joined today by John Littering. You can follow John on Twitter at JonLitterine. You can follow me at RotoJake. Today we're going to make our picks for the biggest fights, mostly the pay-per-view card at UFC 249. Justin Gaethje, Tony Ferguson. This one's being billed as the most stacked card of all time. We finally get fights back. We finally get sports back. So I'm pretty excited for this. How about you, John?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely excited. I think as, you know, big sports fans, both of us, it's obviously great to have something back. Obviously, in the grand scheme of things, athletics is not that big a deal, and it pales in comparison to, you know, the things going on in the world right now. But it's a good distraction, if nothing else. So we'll keep our fingers crossed that everybody gets to Saturday in one piece.
Yeah, we were chatting before this. It's like, okay, first we got KBO, got some NASCAR coming up. We might have German soccer in June, but we finally get fights here. It's been a couple months since we last talked, John. You know, we talked for the Romero Adesanya fight that turned out to be not so hot, but the co-main event, of course, was awesome. And then Brazil shortly after that was the last UFC fight for a few months. So the big thing that's changed, I guess, in our world as far as fantasy goes, is FanDuel has added a game to the offering because, you know, with one of the few sports in town, these sites definitely have to take advantage and it helps them stay afloat for sure. So we have a new FanDuel game, and I wanted to just, you know, we've always focused this thing exclusively on DraftKings because that was the only show in town. But I'll try to mention a little bit of FanDuel salaries. There are some noteworthy differences. But I also want to talk about just the difference in the style of the game. I mean, the biggest difference is there's a captain. And you get 1.5 times the scoring for the fighter you designate as your captain. The salary you pay for that fighter doesn't change, but you get 1.5 times the scoring. So basically, you know, for GPPs, you maybe want to pick someone a little bit unique. Otherwise, it's basically the guy who you think is most confident is going to win and most confident to be a big scorer here. We talked about this in the comments of your articles, but did you have any early leans for a captain spot? I mean, mine was Francis Ngannou. That seems to be the chalk play, right?
Yeah, I would think so. We'll talk about that fight in depth in a few minutes, mm-hmm. but yeah, that would certainly be the leading candidate. I guess you could make some arguments with some lesser, you know, some cheaper fighters. I mentioned Donald Cerrone, maybe Carla Esparza if you think she has a strength advantage, but mm-hmm. if you're going just straight up confidence level, I think Ngannou's the pick.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and he's not the biggest betting favorite on this card necessarily. That honor goes to Ryan Spann at -390. I'm worried about that fight with Sam Alvey. That's not one we're going to discuss in depth, but I think that one stands to be pretty slow pace here. So the first big difference is the captain on FanDuel, of course, and there's general salary differences. Most of the scoring categories, though, they're pretty much the same. The only the big differences we highlighted here, FanDuel awards 5 points for a submission attempt, and they also award 3 points for a takedown defense. Unlike DraftKings, it doesn't seem that they award points for reversals or sweeps, so things like passing guard or reversing after you get taken down, maybe taking your opponent's back, that kind of thing, to put it in the simplest terms possible here. But do you see, I don't know if that submission bonus is enough to really change my strategy a ton. John, maybe guys like we were talking earlier, submission specialists, Olenek and Verdum, they go against each other, so that's going to be a little bit difficult. Maybe a guy like Jacare Souza could be a little bit more valuable. Is that kind of the direction you're heading with that, or don't you see much change?
I mean, I don't think I see a ton of change. Guys like that would probably be the guys who are the most valuable as far as the difference between the two. But it's really, we talk about this a lot, it's really hard. Even guys like that who are, some of the best submission specialists in the world, it's really hard to go into a fight and project a submission. Mm-hmm. Simply because it comes as a result of what happens during the fight. There's a whole set of circumstances that need to take place in order for a guy to be able to clamp on a submission. And it's easier with a knockout. You say a guy's got huge power, those come more frequently. So, I would keep it in the back of my mind. But as far as setting a lineup or whatever, I don't think it would have a huge impact on what I did.
Yeah, and on any other card, I think that would make Alexei Olenek more attractive just because he's the boa constrictor. Yeah, he's getting older. He's had 60-some pro fights, tons of submissions, I think 40 or so submission wins. I don't have his page up. I'm just kind of spitballing here. But on a normal night, Alexei Olenek, that might be a little bit more attractive. However, you get him going against Fabricio Werdum. Obviously, he's off the long layoff. I think he popped for something a while back. But Werdum is known as one of the best heavyweight submission artists of all time. So I don't think you can necessarily boost Olenek as a big underdog in there. Maybe you boost Werdum a little bit. I'm a little shaky on that one. Maybe we can talk about that fight a little bit more towards the end. But those are the big highlights. There are slightly differences in the amount of points for like a fourth and fifth round win. It's different on FanDuel, not so much on DraftKings, but generally they're proportionate. 12 points for a knockdown on FanDuel, 10 on DraftKings. The other thing I mentioned, the there'll be less ties on FanDuel, I think, with 0.6 points awarded for a significant strike. I'm not 100% sure on this, but I don't believe they use the same stat provider, so you might see some slightly different numbers there. So any closing thoughts on that before we jump into the card?
No, I mean, I think it's just another instance of, you got to get a few events under your belt to get a rough idea of if there's really any difference in the game or anything. For now, I'd probably just tell people to lean towards whatever they were planning on doing on DraftKings and just copying it over or whatever. I don't think you're going to see a gigantic difference either way.
Yeah, and my big takeaway is FanDuel even more so than DraftKings. You're going to have to leave some salary on the table here, because I think FanDuel leaves the door open to get five favorites in your lineup here, but that's a pretty chalk lineup, and maybe that's okay for the cash games they're throwing out there. But for their big tournament, let's see, what is their big tournament? I want to check that out quick. I had a thing up in the Kimura that was Google DraftKings, at least we know their big tournament is giving away $200,000 to first, $1 million overall in the prize pool. That's the best we've seen in MMA history here. FanDuel's a little bit less than that. Their Saturday UFC Octagon, it's an 888 entry, $300,000 guaranteed with $100,000 to first on FanDuel. And like I said, DraftKings, the entry, it's a $20 entry, $200 to first, $1 million guaranteed. So those things are, they're on pace to fill up. I saw DraftKings was doing their marketing thing. So if you're thinking about it, maybe go for an entry right now and then save that and adjust as the week goes on. Maybe if we see a unique weigh-ins, that kind of thing. Anyway, before we jump in, I want to mention, we're still partnered up with our friends over at ESPN Plus. You can sign up with the links on our site, and we'll give you a free month of RotoWire full service, all sports, DFS tools. That includes esports, KBO, what have you. Go to rotowire.com/subscribe and locate the ESPN Promo Plus option on the bottom here. Of course, if you already have an account, click subscribe now in the top right to begin. You can just find me on Twitter if you have any problems with that here. I think this pay-per-view is going to do awesome buys for what this worth. Over under 1 million pay-per-view buys, John?
Oh, man. I'd probably take under just because of the economy right now.
Yeah, the economy is the big
that's the tough factor. Part.
Yeah, because obviously you got quadruple unemployment from the last pay-per-view they had, but I think people are itching. Yeah, based on our...
You're going to have bars and restaurants closed, too. I mean, it's going to be tough.
Well, I think bars and restaurant closing actually might help the pay-per-view number because you have, you know, 100, 200 people pack into a bar, or those people are at home and may have to think about buying it themselves now. So I think that helps. And also, if people are following the less than 10, you know, people might not have UFC parties and stuff like that. It depends. The way traffic spiked for KBO yesterday over on the website, I think that there's going to be a lot of interest in this. But, you know, that's a whole other discussion to have. We'll see. I think it'll do over a million. I think Dana's going to pull this off. But anyway, let's jump in here. We've got our main event. It's going to be an interim lightweight championship fight. Of course, this is supposed to be Khabib Nurmagomedov and Tony Ferguson. Those guys are supposed to fight on April 18th. That fight got scrapped. Well, Khabib dropped out because he was kind of stuck in his home country there and couldn't travel here. The UFC rescheduled Tony Ferguson and Justin Gaethje, an excellent opponent. Great fight, no doubt about that. And then, of course, that event got scrapped. So I thought at first maybe we'd go back to Khabib and Tony for a later date. Instead, we're going to press forward with this Ferguson-Gaethje fight. The salaries on DraftKings, Ferguson $8,700, Gaethje $7,500. This is one of the areas where FanDuel's a lot closer. $17 FanDuel, $17 for Ferguson on FanDuel, $15 for Gaethje on FanDuel. So it's a lot tighter there. The betting odds I just checked, Ferguson minus 185, comeback on Gaethje plus 160. I want to see if this has changed because this was the biggest odds to finish mark on the card. At the time we posted, the article is minus 475. Dipped a little bit. I'm seeing minus 450 now, but I'm also seeing minus 525. William Hill has it at minus 455. So this is one of the bigger odds to finish on the card here. I guess I'll just toss this over to you, John. What's your thoughts of this fight happening and what happens to Khabib? And then we can kind of get into the breakdown of this fight.
I mean, it's a fight that makes sense. The UFC, you know, is obviously with everything that's going on right now, really, Dana White really pushed to get a card here. And in order to get that card, you need a really big fight. I'm not a big fan of interim title fights. I think they're generally made up to drive up pay-per-view buys or whatever. This one actually makes some sense. It's disappointing that, again, we weren't able to get Khabib and Ferguson. I want to say they've tried to do this thing 5 times now, and it's fallen apart each time for a variety of different reasons. And they're by far the two best lightweights in my mind in the world. I think there's a decent chance there's a gap between Khabib and Ferguson, but I definitely think there's a gap between the two of them and whoever you think is third, whether that's Justin Gaethje or whoever else. But this, whoever you think is third. But you know, I think there's a gap there. This is a good fight between two guys who just full bore the whole time, uber aggressive. Ferguson, like I've said numerous times, is the rare guy who's gotten considerably better as he's aged. He's won 12 fights in a row, and they've been 12 legitimate wins. You know, Donald Cerrone, Anthony Pettis, Kevin Lee, Rafael dos Anjos, Edson Barbosa. There are big names in there. It's not a puff winning streak where he just beat a bunch of bums. He's fought well. Tony Ferguson is one of the more unique offensive fighters in the company, really in the sport. Does a lot of crazy things. He's aggressive. I would say he has no weaknesses. He can wrestle if he has to. He's certainly competent on the mat.
He's good off his back, which is one thing that you rarely say about a fighter. Yes. You have to worry about him throwing a sub or throwing an elbow.
Yep, he's terrific. Now he's fighting a guy in Justin Gaethje who, I will admit, has had more successful run in the UFC than I expected. He's 4-2, but as far as stylistically, he's still the same guy he's always been. He just is a one-dimensional brawler. He goes in and he tries to knock his opponent's head off before he gets his head knocked off. And he's been able to survive up until this point because, one, he's probably about the toughest guy on the planet, and two, because he has legitimate power. Now, it's a shame because he doesn't use any of his secondary skills. This is a guy who was a former Division I All-American wrestler, but he just simply refuses to wrestle. And Gaethje has openly admitted this. You know, he says he's there to put on a show. So that's what he does. And he's surviving because he has power and because he can take a punch as well as anybody on the roster. Gaethje himself.
You see the Ferguson versus Homer Simpson memes out there because the dude can take a punch. He can get hit.
Yeah, he can. He really can. And he's giving away a ton to Ferguson as far as all-around skill simply because Tony's willing to use his secondary weapons and Gaethje isn't. Gaethje might be a better – there's probably a decent chance he's a better wrestler than Ferguson, but he won't use those skills, so it's not going to make a difference. Here's the thing that I'm picking Ferguson, and the main reason why is – everybody talks about Gaethje's durability, and it's terrific. He's been, I want to say he's been knocked out. He's lost two fights in his career. I think he's been knocked down both of them, Dustin Poirier and Eddie Alvarez back-to-back. Mm-hmm. In both those fights, he certainly did his fair share of damage prior to losing. The Eddie Alvarez fight was at the end of the third round. The Dustin Poirier fight was the beginning of the fourth round. So, you know, if you're fighting for the better part of 20 minutes against this guy, you know he's going to get his offense in. So he's been knocked out twice in his career. Ferguson somehow has never been knocked out. He's lost three career fights, been submitted once, dropped two decisions, which is amazing to me considering how aggressive Ferguson fights. He turned 36 years old in February. He's not getting any younger, but he's legitimately getting better. And I think the perfect example of Ferguson's durability was that Lando Venata fight. I'm pretty sure that was Venata's first fight with the company, and he came in as a late notice replacement.
Yeah, and was Ferguson after a long layoff of almost 18 months. He had fought – Ferguson defeated Barboza in December of 2015 and then was gone – not 18 months, you know, more like 6 months, sorry. But Lando Venata, it was the following July of 2016 that happened. So, yeah, it was a long layoff for Ferguson, and that's one that I wanted to bring up as well because Venata had him rocked, but he survived.
Yeah, no one ever talks about this because how good he is offensively. Ferguson can take a punch. Like, he really can take a beating. And it doesn't get talked about in the same mention as Gaethje simply because Gaethje's entire fight is a brawl while Ferguson does some different things. So, look. If you think Gaethje is going to win, or if you think he's a quality underdog play, the attraction is that the odds of Ferguson coming right in and blasting him and getting him out of there in, you know, a minute or 2 minutes or whatever are extremely, extremely small. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, if you're going to get rid of Justin Gaethje, you're going to have to pound him over a long period of time. It's not going to be, you know, not going to be one strike that's going to get him out of there. So that's the attractiveness there. You're hoping, if you're a Gaethje fan, that he's simply going to be able to take everything Ferguson throws his way, survive it, and then somehow just land enough offense of his own to win. I would term it unlikely. I would say the odds and the salaries here, DraftKings wise, 8,700, 7,500, Vegas odds, minus 185, plus 160 are both about right. The odds to finish seem a little high to me simply because these are two guys who have been combined to be stopped, knocked out twice in their entire career. So, but that being said, I expect so much offense to be landed in this fight that I think over the course of 25 minutes, there's a pretty decent chance this thing doesn't see the final bell. I'd be very, very surprised if this isn't – now, we've said this before, maybe not to this level, but you mentioned earlier the Israel Adesanya Yoel Romero fight a few months ago that everybody thought was going to be this action-packed barn burner and was one of the worst title fights in the history of the company. Mm-hmm. So anything can happen. But I'd be pretty surprised if this isn't the epic clash entertainment-wise that most people are expecting.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll say right off the bat that I'm going to pick Ferguson in this fight. I think he's a more well-rounded fighter. You know, he's been training nonstop. He even did a mock weight cut last month, you know, for when he was supposed to fight April 18th. He's a unique, a little bit unorthodox guy, but you know he's coming in just as prepared. Not to say Gaethje isn't, but I just think Ferguson's a more well-rounded fighter, and he has more ways he can win than Gaethje. And, you know, to backtrack to that Yoel Romero Adesanya fight, I wish I could dig up who said this on Twitter. Sorry if you're listening, but there was a good bit of analysis here regarding Romero's wrestling, where even if we know a fighter has one elite skill, you can't suddenly count on them to use it if you've never seen it deployed in the octagon before. And that's, I mean, Yoel Romero maybe has arguably used his wrestling more than Gaethje. Gaethje is the All-American wrestler. He has that skill. But if you're trying to use him on in a DFS lineup, or you're trying to make a bet on Gaethje, your reasoning can't be because he should have a wrestling advantage. That can't be the reason here, because we don't know for sure he's going to use it. He most likely won't. And then we go back to those comments I made about Ferguson earlier about him being quite dangerous off his back. So for that reason, you know, that's just another notch on the belt for Ferguson there. I'm picking him as well here. I do want to play a little devil's advocate, because I know our picks align a lot in this fight. If you were going to pick Gaethje, here's why you would do it. You could say that although Ferguson's been improving, he's 36 years old. You could make an argument that maybe his best days are behind him, and you get ahead of the turning point, what have you, whereas Gaethje is 31, which should theoretically be in his athletic time, in his athletic prime, excuse me. So that's one reason you could get behind Gaethje. The other is you could maybe, if you wanted to, poke some holes in the Tony Ferguson record. I mean, both of them fought Donald Cerrone, who obviously didn't look great against Conor McGregor. Both of them actually fought Cowboy in their last fight. I mean, Cowboy's fought some of the cream of the crop lately. He's had a tough break. But if you go back on Ferguson's record, you know, Anthony Pettis, okay, another guy whose best days are probably in the past. Kevin Lee had that good head kick knockout against Gillespie, but then he was, you know, and then he's had a rough patch too. Rafael dos Anjos has moved away from the division at this point, and Lando Venata, who actually had Ferguson rocks. So you can make a case that Gaethje is the best opponent that Tony Ferguson has faced since, I don't know, I'm going down this list, maybe ever. You could definitely make a case that this is the toughest fight of Ferguson's career. And of course, there's that 5 years age difference where one is in their athletic prime. So if you're going to make a case for Gaethje, I would do it that way and not try to convince yourself that he'll use his wrestling, because we don't know that's going to happen. The last thing I want to discuss on this, John, before, or actually I have 2 points. One is that if you're a Gaethje believer, you get a much better value for him on DraftKings than FanDuel. The salaries, like I said, are really tight on FanDuel, but not so much on DraftKings. So you get more lineup flexibility using Gaethje there. The other point I wanted to make, I wanted to ask about, is I think ownership percentage is going to be high for both of these fighters. You said that you think those odds to finish numbers are a little bit lofty. You know, if this fight gets into round 4 or 5, a stack will definitely be in play. Can you see a stack in play at all?
Yeah, it's probably one of the rare. I mean, we don't advocate that very often, and I still wouldn't advocate it if you're, you know, the kind of person who only puts in a couple lineups. But if you're putting in, you know, 50, 100 lineups, whatever you're doing, you could do it here. It's just, it's so risky. It's just, if you do, and God forbid for you, one guy finishes the other quickly, it's just, you're not winning a cent.
Yeah, you can kiss your 200K.
It's goodbye. It's like the ultimate roll of the dice. And
yeah,
it's a strategy that sounds good on paper sometimes, but really doesn't pay off all that often, yeah, which is why we generally don't advocate doing it.
Yeah.
You would have thought the Romero Adesanya fight would have been, you know, maybe not a stack, but at least a fight where both guys
stacked that, you won.
You're done. So it's really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. So in general, if you're kind of new to this podcast, new to DFS, you know, you try to stack fighters that are durable and high volume, and that is both of these guys for sure. So you're going to see stacking this be popular. But like you said, John, it rarely works out. I mean, very few instances off the top of my head really jump to mind. I mean, of course, got a little recency bias. That Wiley Zhang Joanna fight would have been a pretty good stack because it saw the final bell, both threw an incredibly high volume. You know, if you're a more casual fan listening, Conor McGregor, Nate Diaz 2 was actually would have been a very productive stack. Both of those guys scored a ton of points in that fight. I think I had picked Diaz in that fight to win, and he still ended up getting like 80 DraftKings points or something.
And on the other hand, though, you would have thought that the Conor McGregor Jose Aldo fight would have been, you know, a back and forth affair, and it was over in whatever it was, 13 seconds. So it's really hard.
Yeah, exactly. You could have, I mean, you could have done the same with Conor Cerrone. Like, oh yeah, Cerrone's generally pretty durable. He had that one knockout, but he'll be fine. And then poof,
it's over.
You
know? Yeah, it's hard.
He lands one significant strike, and when you get half a point or 0.6 points from one of your six fighters, you're absolutely toast. So it's a risky game. I could see it more as a cash game strategy than a GPP strategy, just because there's something to these odds to finish being way bigger than the heavyweights. So somebody might get beaten. It could, but I don't think it'll be in the first round, maybe round two, three, or four, somewhere in the middle of the fight. Do you like over or under on 2.5 rounds, John?
Probably over.
Yeah, I think I'm leaning that way too, which would direct you to a stack. But again, there are very, very specific instances here. But we've dug into this one quite a bit. Let's keep moving on. We got another title fight on the line. I thought it was, obviously the name recognition plays a big deal here, but I thought it was a little curious. The actual title is the co-main event, and the interim title is the main event. But nonetheless, co-main event is a bantamweight championship. Henry Cejudo was supposed to fight Jose Aldo when this card was originally scheduled to take place in Brazil. Of course, Aldo moving down to bantamweight. Instead, we get a name that new fans probably don't recognize a ton, but he's definitely regarded as one of the best, if not the best, bantamweights of all time. That's Dominic Cruz. He could certainly cement that legacy if he comes back and pulls the upset over Cejudo here on Saturday. Cejudo's 8,800 on DraftKings, Cruz 7,400. Cejudo 19 on FanDuel, Cruz is 12 on FanDuel. The odds look like Cejudo minus 230 and the comeback on Cruz plus 190. Odds to finish plus 160. So Vegas thinks this one is going to see all five rounds here. The biggest factor in this one, I think, that everybody will tell you is it's been just about 4 years since Dominic Cruz last had a fight. He's been one of the most injury-plagued fighters. One of the most skilled, no doubt, but also one of the most injury-plagued fighters. That's 1,266 days since Cruz last made the walk when fight night comes. John, how much of a factor is that going to be, and what's your general breakdown of this fight?
I think it's a factor. I always think it's a factor. Dominic Cruz is legendary for saying that octagon rust is mental. It doesn't exist. It's all in your mind. I would strongly disagree with that. It's like any other sport. You know, you could be rehabbing and practicing with your team, but until you're actually playing the games, it's not the same thing. You're right. It's going to be well over 3.5 years. By the time Dominic Cruz stepped into the octagon on Saturday, his most recent fight, December 2016, he entered as the UFC bantamweight champion and was thoroughly dominated, I would go as far to say, by Cody Garbrandt in a unanimous decision loss.
And that's deceptive, because if you look at the stats, Cruz technically landed more, but the Garbrandt shots were much more devastating.
Yeah, Cruz got pounded in that fight. And I was surprised. I thought Cruz would win that fight easily because Garbrandt is another guy who's known as a power puncher who doesn't pay a ton of attention to his defense. And in his heyday, Dominic Cruz was known for having arguably the best footwork in the history of the sport, constantly moving, never standing still. And I thought he'd be able to go about his business and pick Garbrandt apart just by moving. And that didn't happen. You know, Cruz, he's not super old. He's 34 years old. He'll be 35 in early September. So you know, he's not ancient. But this is a pretty big ask for a guy who has been away for more than 3.5 years. Cejudo has quickly established himself as one of the best pound-for-pound fighters in the world. A lot like Tony Ferguson has gotten legitimately better as he's gotten older. You don't really see that too much, at least not to this level. Mm-hmm. You see guys improve. Yeah. But
Cejudo always had the wrestling, but you know, maybe in his case he just needed years and years to fine tune the striking aspect.
Now,
suddenly we see some power here and he's rounding himself, you know, kind of becoming a well-rounded fighter.
Yeah, that was always the thing with Cejudo. So obviously he won a gold medal in the Olympics. So freestyle wrestling. So you know he's a great wrestler.
And unlike some of the guys we've talked about, he actually uses it.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I've always said if he could just get his striking game to acceptable, you know, it didn't even have to be plus or elite or anything. Mm-hmm. It just had to be acceptable to the point where he could threaten his competition enough with his hands that he could just base his entire attack around his wrestling game. Mm-hmm. And I would go as far as to say now that his striking game is a strength. You know, he's not the best striker in the company. Mm-hmm. He's not the best striker in the division, but he's solid in that area.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, he's coming off back-to-back TKOs, one in the first round against a juice to the gills TJ Dillashaw, and two against Marlon Moraes, you know, one of the better bantamweight fighters in the world, you know, in the third round. So the power is there now.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, the concern for a while when Cejudo was a flyweight, Cejudo was a big flyweight. And we know he had the issues cutting weight early in his career and stuff. I thought he would really struggle with the physicality of bantamweight. He's still I would term him probably undersized to division. But when he won the UFC bantamweight title in July over Marlon Moraes, I picked Moraes in that fight, and I picked him Moraes simply because he's a bigger, more physical fighter. And I thought that would be enough to get past – that would be enough of a reason for him to get past Cejudo. And I was dead wrong. He's just – he's gotten to the point where he's just – he's a really good all-around fighter, Cejudo. And he's a really good all-around fighter in multiple divisions. And I think it's funny. I mean, this doesn't have anything to do with anything, but how Cejudo's kind of – changed his entire shtick along the way. You know, he was like a quiet guy who you didn't hear much from, and now he's, you know, asking Nikki Bell on dates and
he's
going
the king
on
of cringe. That's
yeah, he, you know, he's posting wild photos of himself on Insta, all this crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. And you know what? Good for him. We've talked about a bunch of guys in here in this spot where you'd say, oh wow, you know, the guy's a really good fighter, but you know, Demetrius Johnson is probably the best example. The guy's a really good fighter, but you know what? His personality is kind of boring. So people aren't dying to see him fight. Well, you know what? Cejudo's undergone, you know, and like everybody else and everything else and Conor McGregor and all that. Yeah. It's an act.
Yeah, the whole intergender champ wanting to fight Valentina Shevchenko.
It's nonsense to get his name
in
the news.
Triple C. Yeah, every time the camera pans to him in a crowd, he does the most ridiculous grunting facial.
Yeah, it's all an act. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I guess he's doing his job because here we are talking about it.
Yeah, exactly. And he's going to have a lot of eyes on him in this co-main event spot. I'll make a couple points here. You know, I'm picking Cejudo as well. It's the layoff for Cruz and the age. But the other thing with Cruz is, like you said, he was handled pretty tough by Cody Garbrandt. Cody Garbrandt hasn't exactly had the latest – didn't exactly look all that great in his fights
He's regressed since then, definitely.
Yeah. So after beating Dominic Cruz in 2016, Garbrandt was knocked out by TJ Dillashaw twice within two rounds. Granted, like I said, roided up, PEDs. You can talk about how much of an effect that had. It certainly could have. And then after that, Cody Garbrandt got knocked out by Pedro Munhoz in the first round. So, you know, he didn't pop for anything. So, you know – I'm not quite sure if Cody Garbrandt was who we thought he was after he beat Dominic Cruz here. Now, again, I'm picking Cejudo. I think if you can fit him in your lineup, it's not a bad move because, especially on FanDuel, you know, you'll get all those takedowns. Maybe he'll throw some subs. Who knows? Actually, Cruz has an 83% takedown defense, so that's the thing. So I don't. Cejudo might just have to get this done with his striking, which is a dangerous, you know, preposition against Cruz. If this fight happened 5 years ago, I'd pick Cruz and I wouldn't think twice about it. Like it wouldn't matter. But you know, with the layoff and the momentum that Cejudo's been able to build, I think you have to go Cejudo in this one. You know, if you're going to make a case for Cruz, or you'll say that he has a 4-inch advantage in both height and reach, and of course that 83% takedown defense should be able to create distance and keep Cejudo off him if he wants to. I just don't know what kind of Dominic Cruz we're going to see. So, you know, staking a lineup, yeah, you might get some exposure to Cruz if you're, you know, if your money bags are going to max enter the million with 150 entries. Yeah, you got to get some exposure to Cruz in that scenario. But I'm not necessarily sure I like it. I also don't really like a stack in this one because these guys are good volume, but not necessarily exceptional volume. And plus, we have no idea how Cruz is going to adjust his strategy here. I'm looking at the volume. Both of these guys are under 4 significant strikes landed per minute. Cejudo with the edge, 3.82 to 3.53. And if you look at the main event here, you know, just because we're talking about comparing the stack possibility, Tony Ferguson, 5.81 significant strikes landed per minute. Justin Gaethje, 8.57. Now, Justin Gaethje also absorbs 9.67. So that tells you that per minute. He gets popped 10 times significantly per minute. But again, he breaks all stat algorithms. So again, if you're comparing the stack worthiness, not as good as the main event, in my opinion, just because of the volume, even if it does go the full five rounds. I mean, a 3-round fight between Ferguson and Gaethje gets as many significant strikes as a 5-round fight between these two. So I'd be in on Cejudo. I'm not positive about a finish, but I think that he's going to be able to get this done, and I'm not going to overthink this. So I'm going Cejudo.
Yeah, I mean, I think the allure, if you like Cruz as an underdog, I think the allure is at his peak, he was known for having some of the best cardio in the sport, and he had the foot speed to essentially give every fighter he fought problems in one way or another, mm-hmm. Whether it was offensively or even more often or more frequently defensively. He just moved his feet so well that he simply wasn't there when his opponent hit him, but it's a really tough sell given how long he's been away. Look, you know, I don't doubt that Dominic Cruz has always been one of the hardest workers in the sport. So mm-hmm. I don't doubt that he's going to show up ready to fight. You know, I don't think that's the issue at all, but it's a long time away and mm-hmm. you know, we'll see what happens. It should be a good fight.
I'm curious with the foot injury and the arm injury, like with the 4 years off, how much has he actually been sparring in his camp? That's what worries me a little bit. You know, not that you necessarily need to be sparring five times a week to stay at an elite level, but you also can't take multiple years off from, you know, full go sparring. You have to at least match that intensity at a couple points. And I'm sure he's gotten to that point during his camp here. We'll definitely see about that here. But let's move on. This fight, John, I'm probably most excited about this on the entire card. Francis Ngannou did let me down once, but more often than not, he delivers, and I think he's going to deliver again here. Francis Ngannou will be taking on Jair Rozenstruik. Ngannou's 9,100 on DraftKings, Rozenstruik 7,100. The discrepancy is very similar on FanDuel, $22. He's more than twice as much as Rozenstruik, who is $10 on FanDuel. The odds, minus 270 for Ngannou, comeback plus 230 for Rozenstruik. Odds to finish, minus 300. I'm picking Ngannou. I'll come right out and say it. It's pretty simple. I can get into it a little bit in a second here, but I want to hear your breakdown, John, and I want you to look at the whole card and tell me, is Ngannou the biggest lock?
I was just going to say, that odds to finish seems really, really low to me.
Mm-hmm. If it weren't for the Derek Lewis fight, I'm pretty sure that those odds to finish would be like minus 800. Someone's going to sleep.
That's crazy low. I mean, the Ferguson Gaethje fight is minus 475, and you're telling me this is minus 300? That's not right. That doesn't seem right.
So it moved a little bit. I'm looking at minus 325 to minus 360 now. But when I posted your article a few days ago, it was at minus 300. Now,
I would have guessed minus 500, minus 5, you know, somewhere in some astronomical number. Mm-hmm. You know, this is it is what it is. You know, I don't think there's a ton to really break down technically here. These are two of the most massive human beings on the UFC roster who just go in, and we'll throw the Derek Lewis fight aside because that was, you know, is what it is. But guys who just go in and swing for the bleachers with every single punch that they throw. And if you're telling me that's what's going to happen, I don't care who he's facing. There's not a guy in the division or the roster I'm picking over Ngannou. Mm-hmm. If it's just two guys going in and blasting each other, I don't care what he did in his last fight. I don't care what he did two fights ago. He is the pick every single time until further notice. Mm-hmm. And what I don't get about this is, which isn't being talked about, is Rozenstruik was 4 seconds away from losing to a washed-up Alistair Overeem. And not like, you know, all right, he didn't look great, he's going to drop a decision, whatever. He was getting worked. Like, he was getting dominated. And Overeem is essentially done, in my opinion. He's fighting Walt Harris a week from this coming Saturday. So you'll be able to read that, you know, in the preview. I'll talk more about Overeem there. But
mm-hmm. I mean, Overeem got decapitated by Ngannou.
Oh, yeah. But
iconic uppercut.
Yes. Like, I thought he was, like, dead when it happened. But I don't get the – I mean, Rozenstruik, yeah, he's undefeated. Great. But His cardio wasn't great. Not that Ngannou is known for his cardio either. And but his all-around game, at least to this point, what we've seen, is non-existent. It took a miracle finish for him to get Overeem out of there. And now he's going up against the guy who has consecutive knockout wins over Curtis Blaydes, Cain Velasquez, and Junior Dos Santos. Ngannou is the scariest fighter on the roster, and it's not close. And I'm really, really like this was like one of those fights where this was announced months ago before all this happened.
Mm-hmm. It was supposed to headline Columbus on March 28th, kept getting pushed back because of the pandemic, and here we are.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at this, and this is one of those rare fights where it was supposed to be a main event fight. This was one of those rare main event fights where I looked at it originally and had my pick, who I was going to pick, in 2/10 of a, you know, like it was immediate. Like, yeah. I don't know why they're doing this. It's not close. And look, when you get two guys who are this big and they're going up and just throwing bombs at each other, could Rozenstruik win? Sure. Because they're so big and they're so massive that one punch, more so than any other division, can change everything. But not only does Ngannou crush guys, Ngannou crushes guys when he barely touches them. He grazes them on the ear. He hits them on the side of the head where they're ducking when they're ducking forward, and guys still go to sleep. This is just, you know, this is straightforward for me. You know, the pandemic and everything that's going on might change the timetable, but and depending on what they want to do with Stipe Miocic and, you know, Daniel Cormier and all that stuff, but I think there's a pretty good chance that Ngannou fights for the UFC heavyweight title again at some point in the next 12 months.
Yeah, crazy. I just had a couple notes on this. Obviously, I said Ngannou from the beginning. He's the person I lock into that captain spot on FanDuel immediately. The only downside there is everyone's going to have that same train of thought, and if you're trying to bank a GPP here, then you probably have to maybe go a different direction and hope something strange happens here. We don't talk a ton of bets on this show, but one I did want to there are actually two that jump out to me. So Ngannou is -265 to win. Ngannou wins by KO TKO is -115 where I'm looking at. Let me see. William H. has it at -120. We can technically only talk about the legal ones here. So I would bet Ngannou by KO TKO over Ngannou straight up, that's for sure, because you get a much better deal there. The other one that jumped out to me is, this is just a prop, but fight won't start round two is plus money at +120. So if you think there's an early stoppage in this one, I jump on that line, and I don't see Ngannou winning a decision or this even going to a decision. I don't see Ngannou throwing a sub necessarily unless Rozenstruik makes it, just leaves his neck out there for a guillotine, which I don't really see. I see Ngannou finishing this one by KO, TKO early. So I'd rather.
Did you say Ngannou by TKO is -115?
These are the ones I'm looking at, and it's not just one sports book either. I'm looking, there are two that have it at -115. William H. is the only one we can actually discuss because it's legal, -120, and -145 in another spot. So, yeah.
Honestly, that seems like a misprint.
It can't be a four sports book have it that
way. Well, I know. I'll openly admit now, I'm not a big straight up, you know, odds gambling, Vegas odds type guy, but that seems like shockingly low, but it can't be an error. They all have it listed in the same area.
Yeah. So check your apps if you're in a state where it's legal. I'm in Wisconsin, so we're not going to have it legal for a little bit. So, you know, but yeah, if you can find a provider that's taking those odds, I like it very much. But yeah, so those are the notes on this thing. There's not too much to go into beyond that. We both love Ngannou. I'd be shocked if Rozenstruik pulled the upset. If you had 100 DraftKings lineups, John, do you use Rozenstruik in more or less than 3.5 of them?
All right, maybe I'll say more and use him in 5.
There you go. All right. So that's about as much faith as we have in here. Even though Ngannou is not the biggest betting favorite on the card here, he looks great for fantasy purposes.
Yeah, it's
here
a stylistic thing. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, Rozenstruik is a brawler, and that's, you're not picking Ngannou. You're not picking anybody who's a pure brawler against Ngannou. If you're going to beat him, you're going to have to do what Stipe did and make him work. And that's, at least from we've seen, that's not Rozenstruik's game.
Exactly here. Well, we got two more fights on the pay-per-view we want to break down. Maybe do a little mix and matching at the end. But I want to touch on Jeremy Stephens, Calvin Kattar. This is another fight that is supposed to happen at the last card. Had to get moved up and ends up being part. It's a good fight on a pretty solid card here. Stephens is $7,300 on DraftKings, $14 on FanDuel. Kattar is $8,900 on DraftKings, $18 on FanDuel. Odds match up with that. I mean, they're a little closer on FanDuel than DraftKings, but the odds here, Kattar -250, Stephens +210, odds to finish +125. This is a tough one for me to break down, John. They don't have any common opposition here. Do you have any leans on it?
It's tough. I ended up taking Kattar. Stephens worries me a little. He's winless in his last four fights. He hasn't won a fight in over 2 years. There's a no contest in there. If you're a Stephens believer, he's got two things going for him. The first thing is his power is legitimate. Always has been. Stephens has always been known as one of the harder hitters in the 145-pound division. And I don't think that's changed. I think he still has that power. And the second thing you could say about Stephens is he hasn't won in four fights, but those losses are Yair Rodriguez twice, Jose Aldo, and Zabit. So, you're talking pretty much, the highest of the high end. Mm-hmm. Stephens has always been one to take whatever fights they throw at him. It's used lately, at least last few years, it's been high-end competition. Never says no, always gets in there. It doesn't matter who it is. The issue is, that's great, but sooner or later, you have to win a fight. You can't keep not winning. I'm a little worried about Stephens in the sense that I'm worried about Gaethje, and that is and it's been this way for Stephens forever. He doesn't pay attention to defense, and it works when you're facing lesser fighters because your athletic skills or your power or whatever can carry you past those fringe opponents. But once you start facing better competition, you're not going to be able to roll over guys like that without paying attention to defense. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work in any division. I think Kattar's a better play. I'm not crazy about him at all at his price on DraftKings. $8,900 seems kind of high. He's 2-2 in his last four fights, Kattar, so he's not, been lighting the world on fire of late. But again, his two losses came against Zabit and Renato Moicano, who's a good fighter too. So I would argue Kattar's run with the company has been pretty good. He's 4-2 since he got here. He was really viewed as roster depth when he arrived. So when you look at it that way, he was viewed as roster depth a little less than 3 years ago. And now he's here and he's getting meaningful, fights. So that's good. But Kattar's power is also underrated. He has a 2-inch height edge. He has a 1-inch reach edge. And while I think Stephens has more knockout power, Stephens is stubborn. He doesn't adapt to what his opposition throws at him. He's going in and he's fighting the way he always fights, result be damned. And it hasn't worked. I'm a little intrigued to use Stephens here as a DraftKings play because he's so cheap. $7,300 is not a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You can get a whole bunch of favorites in your lineup and still get Stephens in there. It's hard to pick him. I think Kattar is just a better fighter at this point. But if you want to make an argument that Stephens is a better DraftKings play, I'll listen. $8,900. I'm not really into Kattar at $8,900. That's a heavy price for me.
Yeah, especially when the odds to finish are +125. I mean, Kattar finished Chris Fishgold and a late career Ricardo Lamas here in the first round before losing that fight to Zabit. That Zabit fight got moved to the main event of that card, but because it was late, it was only three rounds. Kattar was winning that fight against Zabit in the third round, and Zabit's one of the most highly regarded featherweight prospects on the planet here. I have a lot of respect for Zabit. I think he'll be champion one day. You and I own him in our Dynasty League that we do. Excited.
That's a good pick.
Yes, very excited to have that. With the respect I have for Zabit and seeing that fight, had it gone five rounds, Kattar could have very well beat him. And then compare that to what I've seen out of Stephens lately. I think the pick here is Kattar, but I'm trying to make some DraftKings builds, and I don't really see spots where I'm using either of them because I think Kattar is a little too pricey, and I just don't think Stephens is going to win. So this is a fight that I'm mostly staying away from and looking elsewhere here. One more heavyweight fight to discuss on the pay-per-view card here. Greg Hardy, Jorgen DeCastro. Hardy is 8,600. DeCastro 7,600 on DraftKings. Hardy $17 on FanDuel. DeCastro $12 on FanDuel. Hardy's minus 210 comeback on DeCastro, plus 175. Odds to finish again, minus 225. So which is less than the Ngannou-Rosenstruik, of course, less than the main event here. I don't know how much technical breakdown we can do of these guys because we just haven't seen a ton of film, and the film that we have seen, you know, isn't necessarily the greatest, but obviously Hardy's a big name, so Dana's going to put him on the pay-per-view. I understand exactly the reasoning behind that because they're going to do Pettis and Cerrone, who everybody knows as the finale of the ESPN prelims, to hopefully get everybody tuned in, get everybody hyped up, and get ready to buy that pay-per-view. That I understand here. But as far as this fight here between Hardy and DeCastro, I think there's a lot of potential outcomes here, but which one do you see as most likely?
I don't know. I picked DeCastro to win. Like you said, the range of outcomes here is probably really massive. We all know Hardy's deal. He's got a lot of power. He's obviously a great athlete. You know, he's a terrific NFL player, but we all know the backstory, and you know, it's really hard. And DeCastro's been with the company for all of one official fight. You know, he earned his contract on Dana White's Contender Series, made his debut in October, and knocked out Justin Toffin just over 2 minutes. But, you know, I think anybody who says they have a real idea of what's going to happen in this one is blowing smoke. There's enough fighters on this card that we know enough about and a lot about that I'd probably just stay away from this if I could. It's one of those whatever fights. It has no impact on the division at all. You know, even if Hardy wins as a favorite, sure, he's known because he played in the NFL, but he's not popular with most people for obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And it is what it is. You know, he's
popular because everyone tunes in and wants to see him get knocked out.
Right. He himself, he's not popular in a positive way. So, you know, no matter who wins, you know, none of these guys, both these guys are, you know, countless wins away from impacting the title picture. So it is what it is here. I understand the decision to put Cerrone and Pettis on ESPN, especially with everything that's going on and there being nothing on television. The ESPN prelims are going to – I could see them being like the most watched ESPN prelims of all time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, by a mile. There's no competition. Normally you're going up against baseball in the NBA playoffs.
Anything. Hockey or whatever. So I, in that sense, I get it. And we always talk about how the first fight of Dana and the UFC like to do this. They like to make the first fight of pay-per-view cards – two big guys who rack up knockouts. I don't know if the only thing I can think of is to try and get the crowd into it. You know, maybe some guy scores some crazy high right real knockout or some brawl or whatever, and you get the crowd hot for the rest of the pay per view. Obviously, that doesn't help here. There is no crowd, but in general, I understand the principle.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, looking through this fight, I had a real tough time picking this. I'm leaning DeCastro. Mostly because, I don't know, these odds and salaries, they're more of a coin toss than what this disparity seems them to be. So it's not necessarily that I've got, again, I'm picking DeCastro straight up for our staff picks, but it's not necessarily that I've got overwhelming confidence in either guy. I just think that you're finding value here by going with the cheaper guy. And, I mean, the odds to finish are at minus 225. It's a fight that's likely going to get stopped, and I'll get my salary relief here and hope for the best. But at the same time, if you're entering 100 lineups, you're probably putting each of these guys in 30, maybe 25 at least, because it seems like a fight you want to get a piece of.
Yeah, I mean, I picked DeCastro, I mean, one, because the payoff's better. And I mean, I also guess there's a non-zero chance I just didn't want to pick Hardy because – you know, nobody, you know, for obvious reasons.
I try to really fight through that bias and try to find a reason.
Subconsciously, that's probably part of it too. I mean,
yeah,
you know, we're not going to get into the whole story, you know, and if you're listening to this, you know, Greg Hardy's backstory, but you know,
I want to try to do a little bit technical thing. So Hardy, when he first started in the UFC and when he was doing his amateur fights, it was pretty much opening bell ding. he's balls of the wall, explodes, gives it everything he has right out of the gates, and he did see some success with that. I mean, he won his first three, won his first two contender series bouts, you know, undefeated in three amateur fights, one of them under LFA, you know, beat Juan Adams, who fought him pretty stupidly and is now out of the UFC, you know, beat Smoliakov in the first round. And then you look at the fights where he faced some adversity here. I mean, Volkov was a much better fighter than Hardy. There was, you know, little doubt about that one here. So is the one that was in no contest over her turn because he used his inhaler between rounds, again kind of showing the beginner in him. And then Alan Crowder, the disqualification, the illegal knee there. You'd think Hardy has learned from those things, but there's some risk from paying a high salary for him in case something related to his inexperience comes back to bite you. And you know it's happened twice already, so you can't completely rule it out, even though I assume that he's learning. The other thing is, I mentioned that balls of the wall strategy. It's not happening so much as lately. It's almost he's being more patient and you know, looking for counters, and that's hurt his striking volume a little bit. I mean, he's still 4.77 significant strikes landed per minute, which is pretty solid, but you know, it's not what it was in his early days. And I think DeCastro is not as good as Volkov. If DeCastro and Volkov fought, I'd pick Volkov.
Volkov's one of the best heavyweights in the roster.
But DeCastro's better than anybody else on this Greg Hardy resume I'm seeing right here. So that's why I'm going with that. And of course, DeCastro, we've seen nothing but a couple knockouts. Now, there is a slight chance that we get a little bit of the Ngannou Lewis in this one. If these guys both swing early, and I mean, look at DeCastro. He's not the most, not exactly what you picture in terms of a UFC fighter's pristine physical fitness here. You know, Greg Hardy has him in that department for sure. But both of these guys, you know, DeCastro's hardly ever seen deep waters, and Hardy, when he does see deep waters, he's looked bad. So if this doesn't get done early, there's a chance we get to see two guys swinging non-powerful shots at each other in the third round, which is a bad recipe to start a pay-per-view. But, I don't know. I think UFC matchmakers are maybe want to get Hardy some more wins so they can pump him up a little bit after this recent stretch. So that's the only reason, the narrative-based reason is the only one I can really find to give an edge towards Hardy. Otherwise, this one's a toss-up, and in that case, throwing DeCastro.
Yeah, I mean, Hardy will be 32 in July. DeCastro turned 33 this past December, and they've combined for 13 professional fights. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, you know Hardy. Why Hardy doesn't have any fights? He was playing in the NFL. So that is what it is. But the point is, both of these guys, Hardy in particular, are way, way, way behind where they need to be in terms of reps, which makes the potential outcome even wider. You know, anything can happen here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, this one's going to get interesting. I see why it's starting it off, and we'll see what happens. But as far as fantasy plays go, I give me the underdog in here, and let's see what happens here. Do you want to jump straight to upsets? Is there any other fights in particular that you wanted to highlight, or do those two things overlap for you at all?
I mean, there's a couple. I mean, the one that stood out to me, which I wrote up in long form, and you can read on the preview article, was the Carlos Spars and Michelle Waterson fight. And I wrote that one up. I'll just recap it real quick. I ended up picking Esparza, and to keep it short, essentially it's just Waterson has had a hard time with the physicality of the strawweight division. She's a natural atom weight, which is 105 pounds, which the UFC obviously does not have a 105 pound division. So she's really had a hard time with the physicality of some of her bigger opponents, and Esparza's skill set is really, really limited. But she racks up takedowns. She racks up more than 3.5 takedowns per 15 minutes. Her takedown accuracy is lousy, 36%. That's terrible. Her takedown defense is equally bad, 48%. That's atrocious too. And she's putting herself at risk if she goes to the ground with Waterson, because Waterson is talented on the mat. But I think there's a chance Esparza scores a couple takedowns, maybe one in each round or whatever, and just grinds her way to a win, where it's just one of those fights where you say, okay, great, can I have my 15 minutes back? But that, in the end, that's enough to score her a win. So I'm not crazy about the future of either woman moving forward, which is a real shame, because when Waterson entered the company, she was viewed as really one of the more popular female fighters in the sport, and it just hasn't happened.
She's awesome. I mean, I'm like a fan of her personally. I don't necessarily think she's going to win this fight. I do think the size and strength, or she's technically got more size when you look at him, but Esparza's got the strength advantage.
Yeah, Esparza's a wrestler, and yeah, it's and it's a shame because if Waterson could go back to Invicta tomorrow and fight at 105 pounds, you know, I think she'd be pretty good.
I think she'd be champ pretty quickly.
Yeah, it just hasn't translated. Mm-hmm. So that was just one I wanted to cover quick, but yeah.
Running through, I agree with you in the Cerrone pick. You know, I like to look at different analytics of fights, and the site Fight Matrix tries to compile something, and they have an ELO metric, and they don't have really any upsets on the entire card. The only one is Cerrone, so that caught my attention at first. And when I started looking into this, Cerrone got beat by Pettis in like prime Wheaties box Pettis days. That was a long time ago, almost long enough we
different
can disregard
guy.
That. Different guy, exactly. Yeah, this isn't Showtime Pettis that's running up the octagon anymore, you know, as much as I like the guy home state of Wisconsin here. But I think there's value on Cerrone in DFS because everybody, even the most casual of fans, remember him against Conor McGregor, and he didn't show up, and he admits that he didn't show up, and he got knocked out pretty quick, and he only scored a half a DraftKings point because maybe he got shut out. He might have got shut out for all I know, but he didn't look good from fantasy, from betting, for any perspective in that fight. So I think there's, again, our job is to treat these guys like stocks. Sometimes, you know, we have to take a little bit of the human element out of it. And I think it's a good buy low opportunity on Cerrone. You know, I think he's got his second kid, Riot Cerrone, on the way. And I'm pretty sure he's going to fight, and he's going to fight frequently for a few years longer. And I don't think we see what we saw in the Conor McGregor fight by any means here. I don't think Pettis is capable of delivering that such an electrifying performance at this stage in his career. I think it's a buy low opportunity on Cerrone for both bets and fantasy. And then, you know, looking at other fights, I kind of like Uriah Hall against Jacare Souza. It seems like, you know, Souza's getting up there in age. He's more of a submission guy. I mean, Souza's 40 years old to start with. He's lost three of his last four by decision here. So it's not necessarily that he's been chinny, but, you know, Uriah Hall has put together back-to-back wins. Bevan Lewis, Antonio Carlos Jr., Shoeface, who I think is a very good fighter. Yeah, that was a split decision. But, you know, Uriah Hall at one point was one of the most hyped, had all the tools. I think he still has got some of that in him. And I don't know. I like him. I like his chances of getting the finish against Souza. And, you know, three of his last four, he's gone 3-1 in his last four fights. Two of those were by knockout. So, you know, he's still got some power there at this age. And Souza's best days are going to be behind him. And Hall's never been submitted. And Hall's the underdog. That's the number that didn't make sense to me. So I kind of like Hall as an upset.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing with Uriah is you just don't know what you're going to get from him. You know, he's either get an A or an F. You don't get too many C pluses or B minuses in there with him. But that's not a bad choice. And the other two is I'm not going to pick Alexei Oleinik to win outright. I'm not that nuts. But Fabricio Werdum's looking at, you know, more than 2 years on the sidelines. Like you mentioned, he had that USADA issue and then whole long story. He asked for his release. He ended up coming back. It was all big things. So, you know, like we talked about earlier with Cruz, you know, this is a guy who's been away for a while. Octagon rust is real, regardless of what Dominic Cruz says. And Verdum's been gone for over 2 years. So, you know, maybe Olenek can pull an upset there. He's only 7,000, one of the cheapest fighters on the card. So maybe you get some relief there. And, you know, the other one I wanted to mention quick was the Vicente Luque-Nico Price fight. And Luque is a big favorite, 9,000, minus 265. Price is only 7,200. But this is another fight where this is two guys who all they do is brawl. And Luque's better, but when you got two guys who you know are going to go in there and just stand toe-to-toe and pound the holy heck out of each other, mm-hmm. Hey, maybe Price at 7,200 lands one big shot, you know, that scores a finish. So, you know, it's not like Luque is going to go in there and wrestle, you know, Price, and Price isn't going to get a chance to land his offense. He's going to get a shot. So essentially it's the same argument you're using in a potential Rozenstruik fight. You know, you don't think he's going to win because he's facing somebody better and somebody with more power, but at least the circumstances are there for him to do what he does well. Probably not going to be enough, but he'll get his chance.
This is when I'm on the other side of. We also own Luque in that dynasty thing, for what that's worth. But
oh, there you go.
Yeah, we got him relatively cheap, less than 10% of the budget. Anyway, but no, I'm on the other side of that fight, so much so that I consider Luque as a captain spot on FanDuel. We know he's got a crazy chin. We've seen that in several of his fights. You know, Stephen Thompson couldn't finish him, even though he dominated him. He got hit by Barbarina a little bit too much for my liking, but it really put the chin on display. I think Luque comes back and comes back in a big way. Remember, these two fought already before Luque submitted him in the past in the second round. I dig Luque. I mean, we could talk about all of these fights because it's an exceptional card. I think we did touch on pretty much all of them over the course of this show here. Yeah, we didn't gloss over any of them. We at least had this. We didn't say much about Mitchell and Rosa, but you know, that's pretty straight. I don't know if there's anything there. Not one. The odds to finish on that one are actually not great, if I remember.
Almost 145, I think.
Yeah. So yeah, not a super fantasy-friendly fight, but hey, maybe other people are overlooking it too, and if you pick the early winner, you can get a little GPP edge, which can happen.
Yeah, the only other thing you mentioned, we were talking earlier about the FanDuel captain spot. Mm-hmm. I guess you could also – a guy who we haven't really talked about is – the only other guy who might be a contender is Ryan Spann, and I only say that because Sam Alvey – possesses no footwork whatsoever and just stands there and throws bombs. So,
yeah,
you know, I don't think Spann's particularly good, but he's big. He's 6'5", so he's one of the taller fighters in the division. Big, long arms, long limbs, and, you know, Alvey's lack of defense and lack of footwork, you know, could come in.
I'm afraid of that fight being like a snoozer where the winner gets like 40, 50 DraftKings points. I don't see either of them being a ton of high volume guys or getting it done. And plus Spann, of course, is the most expensive as the biggest favorite on the card. So I don't particularly care for him as the captain. I'm actually probably fading that fight because I guess what are the odds of finish I'm seeing here are -205. So they're not bad, I guess, but I don't necessarily. I mean, maybe they're really motivated. It's the first fight of the whole night on the early prelims. Could be really awesome, I guess, but I don't know. That's one that doesn't necessarily do a whole lot for me. But who knows? That's just me.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if you're trying to win one of those, we say this all the time, you mentioned earlier, you're not playing cash and you're looking for one of those big GPP things, you're going to have to leave salary on the table and come up with some crazy unique combination that you look at it when you submit your lineup and you're like, what the heck am I doing? But that's what wins those things. It's going to be some crazy thing.
Yeah, we both picked, you know, 4 out of 5 favorites on the main card, but there's going to be some upsets on this card. And I bet you when it's all said and done, maybe we only see 3 favorites win on the main card. Something's going to surprise us at some point. It just has that feeling here. But, man, we've gone over an hour. It's been great breaking down fights with you, John. I want to thank, again, our audience for listening to the RotoWire Mixed Martial Arts Podcast. Of course, brought to you by ESPN Plus, the home of UFC 249, the only place you can watch UFC 249. Again, he's John Littering. You can follow him on Twitter at JONLITTERINE. I'm Jake Litarski. You can follow me at RotoJake. We'll be back with you guys prior to UFC 250, whenever and wherever that might be. I know Perth just got canceled this week. The only ones listed on the site are this weekend, and then we're going to do Jacksonville May 13th and May 16th. We'll do some DFS previews for you there. Probably no show unless we're really feeling frisky, but until then, we wish you the best of luck with those daily lineups, and thanks for listening.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.